You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Toku Ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host, Jess, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Nicholas. If I ahine coming up on the show, I asked ACT MP Karen Chua about the National Party joining ACT and opposing government policy to increase housing density in major cities and calls to protect mining from big overseas companies on Aotearoa's conservation land. Hey Nick, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Anu Kaloti about their petition to grant overstayers amnesty that has just been launched on Action Station.
And Leilani is the new host of Tomorrow's World, a segment that explores how science affects people and our future on planet Earth. For her first piece, she spoke to Pippa McKelvey-Sibolo, a doctoral candidate of population health at the University of Auckland, and Lisa Te Morenga, an associate professor in nutrition and Māori health, about how 7 out of 10 type 2 diabetes cases globally are related to poor diet, and how Aotearoa fits into that statistic. He aha o whakaaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wire mai rane, give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Ka oe e wariwari, e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki eni kōrero anohi pakihiri roki roki maurunga I te pai tuku tuku o Erirangi Pōho. Me haere ki 95BFM, era katikom. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Karen Chua.
For our weekly interview with the ACT Party, I asked Karen about National opposing recently introduced housing density standards after the ACT Party has opposed this since the beginning of its introduction, as well as calls to protect mining from big overseas companies on conservation land in Aotearoa. Here is that interview. So why do you believe National has now changed their mind on this policy?
Oh, I mean, I can't sort of get into the minds of what National's thinking. All I can say is ACT opposed this from the very beginning because we actually said that there'll be unintended consequences that come with that. Yes, they talked about it making building houses easier, but what we really needed to be concentrating on was the infrastructure that was needed with all this intensifications. You can't just build up an area like that without forward planning from councils knowing where they need to put the necessities for those communities to continue having a good life in their community. And we're glad National has turned around and seen the light because this was a major issue and ACT has always spoken out against it since it was proposed.
Can you tell me then about how ACT would address the need for more housing in our major cities?
Yeah, so I mean, we do believe that there is an issue and that building needs to happen, but it needs to happen working with the councils to make sure that they have enough funds to be able to build the infrastructure that's needed. ACT's policy would go into sharing GST with councils and allowing them to use that GST to build in the areas where that area may come together and say, hey, we're quite happy to build up this area and these are the things that we need. So we would share the GST revenue every year from housing developments to the councils, and then they would have the resources to build around those houses.
National has specifically called for standards that are sympathetic to property owners. Is this something that ACT would support as well, and how would you do this?
You know what? I mean, private property rights are really important, and we need to make sure that we're not encroaching on other people's rights just to have our own, if that makes sense. So some neighbourhoods may come together and say, hey, we could do this in our community and this is what we would like. And it's about working with communities and taking them on that journey. Otherwise you end up in all the, these cases where communities are coming out and saying, not in our backyard. Whereas if you worked with them and showed them the benefits that that may bring to their community, things would go a lot smoother.
Opposition, as well as ACT, has been critical of Labor for their action on housing. Heading into this year's election, how would ACT be prioritising housing, affordable housing, as well as making sure that there's enough housing for everyone in Aotearoa?
Yeah, housing's a big thing, and big promises were made, and they were never actually delivered. And we could tell from the very beginning that promising to build 100,000 homes was just not going to happen, as much as people said, yes, it will happen. And we've seen that that just couldn't be delivered. We need to be sensible with what we're trying to achieve, and we need to make sure that we're not over-promising and under-delivering. So we need to look at different communities and what they offer when it comes to transportation. Auckland is a difficult one. It's very widespread, so we want to make sure that we're building in areas where people have the infrastructure and the schools and everything they need close around them, or in a place where it enables them to be able to either travel with public transport. And so we need to be very careful with how we're planning. And that's why that bill was so tough, because it took that away from the councils to do their forward planning and know where they needed to put things. Now they'll be able to plan where things are going to go and be able to put that infrastructure in place. And we feel that that will help build in the right places for the right people and make communities a lot better.
With National and ACT sharing a similar position on this issue, as well as a lot of issues around housing and property owners' rights, you seem quite aligned on these issues. Is this potentially setting up for National and ACT to be able to have a possible working relationship depending on the result of this year's election?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's always a medium ground. You're always going to have lots of ideas coming to the table. It's about whether you can actually come together and make those ideas work. And I think ACT and National can work together for a more positive future when it comes to building affordable housing. There's lots of issues there. It's to do with the cost of a build as well, and the compliance and the red tape that comes with that. And I think National and ACT are aligned in those issues as well, and I think there's a lot of work to be done, but I can see a positive outcome.
I also wanted to talk to you about ACT's stance on potential mining by big overseas companies on conservation land in Aotearoa. So the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment has granted an Australian mining giant, Mineralogy, 10 mineral permits to explore and prospect for minerals, including on some conservation land like Puketi Forest in Northland, which this is obviously the step before mining. And the company's now trying for prospecting rights over the Hohonu area near Greenstone, which was revealed to have lithium potential back in 2018. So does ACT believe that big overseas companies like Mineralogy should be able to mine on conservation land here?
Yeah, look, we have to take the whole big picture into consideration, and we need to make sure that ACT would support this kind of thing happening, as long as there is real proper processes put in place and expectations are very clear on restoring the land back at the end of a project, and making sure that that is possible. So ACT does support that, but with a lot of things in place to make sure that we're not going backwards when it comes to our land. So we would make sure that they would have a trust account if they were to do it, and that account would be for restoring the property back after their activities. And this is done in other countries, and I was having a look at some of the work done in Australia, and it showed that DOC and these miners can work together, and the funds that come from a lot of this mining can be put back into into the environment and into nature and the things that we need. At the moment, DOC is scrambling for enough money to keep up with maintenance and pest control and a lot of the work that needs to be done in these areas. And I can't see why we can't have a working relationship between DOC and these miners for a better future for our conservation.
Do you think that the benefits of projects like these in terms of economic benefit outweigh the potential damage to our biodiversity and ecosystems?
Yeah, so I mean, economically, it would help our country. The reason why Australia does a whole lot better than us is because they do take advantage of their natural resources and use them in a way where it helps their economy. I think we talk about potential damage, but we also need to look at the potential good things that can come out of that too. Like when they are restoring them, they're restoring them back to and sometimes even better than what they were before, creating wetlands, planting trees, new lakes, depending on where they're mining. And actually in some areas they've found that the bird life and some of the natural resources in that area have actually got a lot better than where they were before that mining company went in. And they're also contributing to projects that help with that as well, where that money wouldn't have been there beforehand. So I think it's not necessarily one or the other. I think there's a middle ground where they could come together and actually benefit each other.
Pukiti Forest, which is one of the areas that mineralogy has been already given a permit to prospect and explore for minerals, is among the last 1% of unlogged ancient kauri forest. And kauri is really needed to ensure that specific plants can survive and specific animals as well who have evolved to live around kauri. Is this something, this particular area, something that is a concern for you, the potential damage that it could have?
Hey, look, that's not a particular area that I'm well informed upon, so I wouldn't be able to say yes or no to that particular question, because that would be up to the different people to come together and weigh up the pros and cons and make sure that we get the balance right there. So that may not necessarily be something that's good, but it doesn't mean we can't have these conversations and look to using our natural resources in a way to help our country become a little bit wealthier, using our natural resources in a way that works for both conservation and the mining industry.
That was ACT's Karen Chaw talking about National's decision to oppose new housing density standards, as well as ACT's stance on mining in Aotearoa.
That was our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Karen Chaw.
Classic journal question as well. Can I have a jaw?
The Wire.
And we'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Round of ice spot, anyone?
Ice spot? Yeah, sure.
Let's go.
All right. I spot with my little eye something beginning with B.
Bar.
No.
Best mates?
No.
Beverages?
No.
Big dogs?
Yeah, those big dogs.
Come on, you know what it is.
Beersies!
The Beer Spot. With 40 delicious Beersies on tap and 5 locations Auckland-wide, The Beer Spot is your tappy place. For opening hours and to find out more, head to thebeerspot.co.nz.
Month on 95 BFM.
The finest vintage.
Music from Aotearoa. Now and all year round. Only on 95 BFM.
Nobody remembers the ninth commandment.
For old time's sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this clip and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're tuned in to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395. We really appreciate the feedback coming in.
It's time to get action with Action Station Aotearoa, the segment where we chat with the people campaigning for a fairer future.
It is estimated that Aotearoa currently has 14,000 people residing here who do not have visas or any kind of legal status. Recent news about fresh dawn raids by police on alleged overstayers has prompted a spotlight to be placed on how we treat our migrant communities. For our segment Get Action, I spoke to Anu Koloti about their petition launched on Action Station calling for the government to grant amnesty and working rights to overstayers currently residing in Aotearoa.
Overstayers, people without any visas, basically don't have access to a lot of the stuff that Kiwis would. For example, children born to overstayer parents can't necessarily go to school. They don't. They're not able to register with doctors, so no access to healthcare. Obviously, no access to services like benefits from work and income. Generally, we've seen in the pandemic that overstayers were really, really fearful of getting COVID tests and COVID vaccines. It becomes a real health issue, not just for the people affected themselves, but the communities as well. And just generally, you know, they live a life that is not decent, you know, it's not very dignified and it's not respectful, and they just constantly live in fear without the basic essentials that every human being must have.
Yeah, and I read in your petition blurb, you mentioned the UNITIC report into overstayers. Would you be able to summarise some of the key findings of that report?
So the report highlighted some of the issues that I've already mentioned, and in addition, it focused on like family setups, so where both mum and dad are overstayers, and then children are as well, and the toll it takes on their mental health is just immense and horrendous. So you know, constantly living in fear without any status. And then working as well. We talk about migrant exploitation in Aotearoa, but overstayers are one of the most exploited workers because they are working under the table because they have no other choice. So the Tuvaluan Project report highlighted how bad it is for the mental health of those families and those tamariki who grow up in such an environment. So just purely based on that, they were appealing that the right thing to do here is to make them lawful and give them work rights and allow those children to go to school. I obviously can't go into a lot of detail, but there are some really, really gut-wrenching and heart-touching examples in there of how the children deal with the entire situation because, you know, they're not other children who go to school and who make friends and, you know, they get invited to birthday parties of their school friends and things like that. So these children are missing out on a childhood that every child deserves. The report talks to those kinds of issues.
Yeah. And also recently the government just had to apologise for a fresh set of dawn raids on overstayers. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the other kinds of discrimination that people who are overstayers face in New Zealand.
So government's own stats, from July 2022 till to date, there have been approximately 19, that's 19 raids out of hours. We call them dawn raids, the government gets scared of that word, but they are effectively dawn raids, new dawn raids. So out of those 19 people, 9 were of Chinese origin and 4 were Indian, and then the rest are made up of I think Tongan, Samoan, and then 1 or 2 other nationalities. So you know, they're all people of color. Nobody of white skin has been dawn raided in the last year or so. So there is definitely an element of discrimination, racism, I would actually call it. And yes, the Minister of Immigration and Acting Prime Minister, they apologised at this hui about a month ago, but it's a good start. We had the Dawn Raids apology in 2021 from the then Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, but we actually need action, and we also not only just an amnesty for overstayers. I think it also needs to be backed up with better immigration policies for the future, so that we don't go and go through the whole cycle again. So, as you will have seen in the petition, that people become overstayers because of our immigration policies letting them down time and time again. So if we don't go and improve our immigration policies, we will keep getting overstayers. So we would, yes, apology is a good start, but the next thing that needs to be done immediately is giving lawful status to our overstayers, and then also doing a really deep and wide review to improve our immigration policies so that no one is ever forced to be an overstayer ever again.
Interesting. What are those policies that you want to see? What would you like the government to instate that would help us solve our overstayer problem?
Yeah, so a number of things here. If I was to talk to just the workers that we bring in from the Pacific Islands, we have the RSE scheme whereby workers are brought in for a few months to work in the horticulture sector, in our orchards, picking fruit, planting crops, and then once that is all done, they are not allowed to stay here. They are just sent back and brought back again a few months later. It's just the uncertainty and the temporariness of the whole thing that, people want a better life for themselves and for their family and for their children. So we would see that temporariness to disappear. We would want long-term, more permanent visas for our workers from the Pacific Islands. That's one thing. And then where we do have pathways to residency available to our other workers who also come in either as students and then they move on to work visas and they keep going from one work visa to another for a decade quite easily in most cases. We need better pathways to residency and so that people can actually progress much faster and with more certainty. And also what we've seen, if I was to look at the last 20 or so years, we've had one main pathway to residency called the Skilled Migrant Category Residence Visa. Now, this is a system where people test their eligibility and they have to score a certain number of points based on their age, their qualifications, their work experience, and the current job they are doing. Now, the system used to be, I think, around 120, 140 points, and then it got increased to 160 just as National Party was leaving after their 9 years and Labour was entering. And then more recently, the Labour government has increased it to 180. So people, migrant workers on temporary work visas have been working towards that number of points, and they get so close to meeting those requirements and the goalpost moves. So, and that's what's been happening every 2-3 years, that the goalpost keeps moving and then that residence keeps getting further and further away from our work visa holders. So things like that need to be looked at and stopped, because it's really unfair and it's the New Zealand government who promotes New Zealand as a destination where education can be a pathway to residence, come and work here and then you can live here. And the workers are not making it up. It's advertised on government websites. So, we need to stop selling a pipe dream to people. We need to have genuine pathways to residency. And if it comes to a situation whereby we can't take in more workers or we don't need more workers, then we need to be honest and upfront and advertise it. So I think we need to stop misleading and misguiding people.
Your petition currently has 1,083 signatures. What are the next steps after you fulfill your signature requirement?
So as soon as we feel that we've reached a good quantum of our signatures, we will present the petition to the Minister of Immigration and the Prime Minister, and we hope that it does go through the channels that it needs to in Parliament and ends up with a Parliamentary Select Committee. Usually it's the Education and Workforce Committee that looks at immigration side of things. And we hope we get a good and fair hearing. And also, you know, the Prime Minister has indicated that he will seriously look at the petition that was done by the Pacifica community in 2020, soon after we went into lockdown. He said that he will look at it. And then also, we've been working in collaboration with some of the Pacifica community groups. No one seems to know what's happened to that petition, and it's now been, like, good 2 years. It's not acceptable, that kind of time delay, because it impacts human lives in the meantime. And the Minister of Immigration also keeps saying on record that they are seriously considering this amnesty, and I think some noises have been made about the way an amnesty was done in Ireland. So it's just we need to see some action. We've had enough apologies, we've had enough statements of, you know, we are doing X, Y, Z. We actually need to see some action. And leading up to an election, a general election, I think it is pretty important for the Labour Party government to do the right things here.
That was Anu Kalotti speaking about granting amnesty to overstayers. The amnesty for overstayers petition is still available to be signed on the Action Station website.
That was Get Action with Action Station Aotearoa.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
And we'll be back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
One Spider-Man wants to change his own destiny.
This is my chance to prove myself.
Miles Morales returns for the next Spider-Man movie.
Spider-Man, Across the Spider-Verse.
Everyone keeps telling me how my story is supposed to go. Nah, I'ma do my own thing.
Spider-Man is catapulted across the multiverse and must redefine what it means to be a hero.
And then I looked at my uncle and...
Let me guess, he died?
Spider-Man, Across the Spider-Verse, based on the Marvel comic books.
Starts Thursday only in cinemas.
Now it's time for Tomorrow's World, the segment where we consider how science affects the individual and wider society. This week, Leilani spoke to Lisa Te Morena and Pippa McKelvey-Sibilo about how 7 out of 10 type 2 diabetes cases globally are related to poor diet and how Aotearoa fits into that statistic. First, she asked Lisa Te Morena about her research on type 2 diabetes.
So my early research, it looked at diets and it was thinking about what individuals could do themselves to reduce their risk of developing diabetes. But over time, I've become less interested in what individuals can do, because often people are really limited in their ability to access the sorts of healthy foods that we know reduce the risk of diabetes. I've done quite a lot of research over the last decade looking at the role that diets or specific parts of the diet, types of foods, play in treating and preventing diabetes. So my PhD research looked at different types of diets, high protein versus high fiber diets, and whether one was more effective than the other for reducing the risk that someone would go on to develop diabetes. It's been quite interesting, and I think what we know from a lot of the research I've done, or what I've come to believe, is that diets that are high in fiber from things like your fruits and vegetables, but also from whole grain breads and things like porridge and brown rice, that sort of thing, is people who have plenty of that sort of food in their diets have a lower risk of going on to develop diabetes. So I'm a grade 5 advocate.
And how do you think that the Māori statistics fit into the wider focus of this study?
People are really limited in their ability to access the sorts of healthy foods that we know reduce the risk of diabetes. But if you don't have a lot of money and you're struggling to pay your rent, the cheapest food is often the least healthy. It's not your whole grains, and it's not fresh fruits and vegetables, the highly processed foods. And families often, you know, they can't afford food wastage, so you end up buying things that you know your kids are going to eat and that you can afford. So I'm much more interested these days in looking at how we can shift that balance to make healthy foods more affordable and accessible for our lowest income families in New Zealand. And Māori and Pacifica families are often down at the bottom of that socioeconomic ladder. So I'm really keen to see good policy coming out from our government that shifts that balance and makes it easier for our people to have those healthy diets that reduce the long-term risks of diabetes and cardiovascular disease, which actually shorten our lives relative to Pākehā families.
And if you had any recommendations for the health sector and how we're operating now, what changes do you think would help these impacted communities?
Yeah, this is it's a really tough question or a really big challenge to help families right now to afford healthy food. So there are some long-term strategies we think the government needs to consider. You know, one of those is actually bringing together a team of experts to sit down and really map out what are some good fiscal policies around taxes and subsidies and regulations that we need to consider to bring down the cost of healthy food in New Zealand. That's going to take a long, long time. And people are really struggling right now with the cost of food, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners are probably students and have, you know, particularly feeling the pinch right now. I'm shocked at how expensive food has gotten in the supermarket. So one thing we've identified that we think the government could implement right now that would make a big difference to a lot of families, probably not students, sadly, is expanding the Healthy School Lunch program that we have operating at the moment. So currently about 25% of students going to schools that are eligible to get the free Healthy School Lunch program. But unfortunately, we know that at least half of children that are living in households that are really struggling to afford food on a regular basis don't go to schools that get that free lunch program. So we are asking, really advocating, for the government to expand that healthy free lunch program so that at least half of children get that. And we think that could make a real difference right now for a relatively small cost. And that can give the government a bit of breathing space to do some of that more structural thing that's required for long term.
Leilani also asked Pippa McKelvey-Sebelo to expand more on the idea behind free lunches at school.
My name's Pippa McKelvey-Sebelo. I'm a doctoral candidate at the School of Population Health at University of Auckland.
How did you get involved with your research in diabetes?
Well, my research has been based in Hawke's Bay. We've been looking at how to improve children's nutrition through using a couple of methodologies, through systems thinking and incorporating mātauranga Māori into our work down here. I was working as research manager at EIT, which is part of the Te Pūkenga network, what used to be called Polytech. I was research manager down here. And through that work, I really became aware of inequities in our communities. Children who really weren't having enough food to eat at all at home, at school, and also through that, so some of the kind of deficit-based statistics I became aware of. But then also these amazing initiatives that schools were doing to feed those kids and to find their own funding, breakfast clubs, barbecues on Friday, things like this. And I really wanted to understand more about it. I'm also a mum of three children who were born overseas and in the country they were born in, there was just a lunch system in the schools. So I'd seen how that worked. And at the time in 2019, there was talk of introducing a school lunch program in New Zealand, and it did happen. At the beginning of the school term and the school year in 2020, they announced a new lunch program in a pilot in some pilot schools, and Hawke's Bay was lucky enough to be one of those regions. Then we all know what happened in 2020, and post-COVID, that pilot program was massively expanded, and now there's about 200,000 students across the country who receive a free lunch every day. So it was really just a combination of interest from my own personal life and from my professional work that said to me, I've got to understand more about this, and it's a great time to do some research down here on this.
Where do you hope this project will continue to go?
I'm kind of at the end of my three-year PhD work at the moment, but last year we conducted a series of whānau hui, student hui, and principal interviews asking about the impact of what it's been like to have this school lunch program with healthy meals delivered to those kids every day or made on site at school. So the impacts, you know, just from the immediate impact of less hunger, less financial hardship in those families, but also we're starting to see more longer term benefits too of taste preferences changing. So it was really cool in the hui. I had lots of parents talking about how their kids will come home and say, oh, you know, we ate some chickpeas at school, can you cook that? And the parents have never cooked a chickpea before and, you know, don't have any idea, but then they're learning too through what the students are bringing home. So we really are seeing that through being exposed to different, well, diverse diets at school and healthy diets at school, that it can change nutritional preferences. And we know that sets them up for better health over their life as well. So my research has been about gathering those stories and presenting them back and you know, communicating these findings so that, well, the Ministry of Education can take them on board in their policies about how Ka Ora Ka Ako, which is the name of the school lunch program, by the way. Ka Ora Ka Ako means to be well, be well to learn. And so, yeah, so the Ministry of Education can take that on board in their design of their program and their revisions of the program, and so that schools can also take it on board to know how to design their program in the best way to get the best outcomes for students and for the whānau of those students.
And I guess that ties into the last thing I wanted to ask you about. You mentioned to Science Media Centre that we urgently need a national food security plan. What plan would you like to see the government implement?
So I don't know what that plan would look like. That would be part of the process, right? But we don't have a lot of regulation in this country about, well, we don't have a national food strategy. We don't have kind of agreed definitions on some of the things like the word food security or food sovereignty. And I think, I mean, I've just been at a really interesting hui this morning for a regional food strategy here in Hawke's Bay. We are a region known as the Fruit Bowl of New Zealand. Just had a devastating cyclone that has really wiped out primary production in the region for, you know, for this immediate year and for some years to come. But we don't have a strategy for food resilience here, for looking after our local communities, looking after the health and well-being through nutrition of our regional population, and in a national, you know, a nationally led strategy either. So I think there's both a need for kind of national enablement of these regional groups that coordinate strategies and local involvement. So yeah, there's really just an absence of that in New Zealand at the moment.
That was Lisa Te Morenga and Pepe McKelvey Sebelo talking about a new paper exploring diet-related causes of type 2 diabetes and what we can do in Aotearoa to combat it.
Tomorrow's World on 95BFM.
That was The Wire.
Ko iratu hotaka katoa, mō tēnei wiki nite mihi ki a koutou katoa, I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today, and thanks to our producer Nick, as well as Leilani for producing Tomorrow's World, which will be back every second week. Ni ra hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Jules.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.